behind every great beer is an even better story. Welcome to the Beer Healer Interviews. Special guest for this episode of the Beer Healer Interviews. His name is Mitch Ermatinger from Speciation Artisan Ales. Now, I'm expecting that most of you have never heard of this guy or his brewery, and I'll be the first to admit that I hadn't either. But that doesn't matter, because there are great stories to be uncovered in all parts of the brewing world. Mitch was recommended to me by one of my old mates, Steve Harmschild from Lanakai Brewing. You know, the Hawaiian Wild Ales guy who loves to brew with NASA. Anyway, I respect his opinion, so when he suggested I speak to Mitch, I was all in. Mitch is another of those crazy cats who just loves to experiment with their local environment to make unique beers. And in this case, he also makes wines and ciders. His family-owned brewery is based in Michigan, about 50 k's east of Lake Michigan, in fact. So I'm tipping there is an abundance of local produce from which to create amazing beers. So to talk about what it takes to produce these unique beers, welcome to the Beer Healer Interviews, Mitch Ermatinger.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, mate. Thanks for jumping on. Would you believe that you are my first guest from Michigan on the podcast?
It's so hard to believe.
What's the beer scene like in that part of the world?
The beer scene is definitely booming. We're in Michigan. We're maybe like a year or two behind the rest of the country as far as like big fads. But we are still definitely trying to keep up with everybody else. And there's a large amount of breweries that are making really good beer. So yeah, it's a really great scene, really passionate scene too. It's cold here.
Yeah. You're probably not too dissimilar. You might be a little bit colder than where I am. Tassie is probably not quite as cold as Michigan, but similar anyway. And tell us about Speciation, if I pronounce it right, Speciation Ales.
Yes, now, I pronounce it Speciation.
Speciation, yeah. Yep. There's a significance to the name, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. We're kind of, I guess, like an evolutionary biology themed brewery.
Oh, there's so many of those. Why can't you be unique?
Yeah, it's like, for us, it's just like everything we make is different. Like every single beer we make is different and kind of evolves off into its own direction because it's all wild ales. Everything we make incorporates wild yeast in some way and bacteria. And so pretty much everything we make can evolve into its own individual species or its own individual beer. So we kind of taken cues from the idea of, you know, evolutionary biology and applied that to our branding scheme, essentially.
Yeah, because the definition of speciation is the evolutionary process by which populations evolve to become distinct species.
Yes.
Getting all sciencey on you there.
How's that? And I'm not even I'm not even a scientist or anything. I'm just a nerd.
I assumed you were.
Yeah, I know. Everybody does, but I'm not. I just really like David Attenborough and like nature documentaries. No, and biology was my favorite class in college. So I didn't even get a good grade in biology. I just liked it.
Sounds as good an idea as any to name your brewery after.
Yeah, exactly.
I was intrigued. What made you want to take this specific path? I mean, there are easier ways to make beer, isn't there?
Yes, definitely. Definitely. I don't know. For us, I've been brewing for 11 beers. 11 beers. Wow. Sounds like I've had 11 beers already. I've been brewing for 11 years, and most of that time was spent brewing sour beer. And it's just something I've really loved making. So at home, I brewed for about five, six years. And then I started brewing for Black Project in Denver, Colorado. And so that was my first professional brewing job. And I just learned so much there. And I knew when I was working for them that I wanted to open my own brewery someday. So basically, we applied this idea of like sour beer production that I was learning at Black Project to my business plan, which was really abysmal at first, but we kind of adjusted from there. So started off thinking I was going to make like session beers and stuff. And then every time I ran the numbers, it was like, I can never pay my bills. Like I need to start off with $500,000 in order to make session beers, really. Because you have to sell so much volume of it that you need big tanks and you need a big brew house and you need a big tap room to sell it all direct. And so we kind of took it as a practical thing. Like sour beer requires very little startup. And also it was the thing that I was most interested in making anyways. So between those two ideas, we decided to just make, you know, open a sour brewery or all mixed culture, I should say.
That is amazing. Like to hear you say that was the reason why you took that route. Like, I just like, usually, you know, you get involved in a brewery and you love what you're doing. You're really excited about it. I just want to do this. You've actually taken a step back and taken a bit of a pragmatic approach perhaps to creating your brewery, because you've run some numbers and worked out that I can't operate a brewery in the way that, you know, many others do.
Oh, for sure. And I think I never would have thought of it that way until I had worked in a brewery. And also, like, it wasn't like I just decided like overnight that I was going to start a brewery. I know some people do that. But for me, it was an idea that had been building for a very long time and I took very seriously. And so, basically from the first or second batch of homebrew I made, 11, however many years ago, I knew I wanted to start a brewery more or less. And I just was, it was an idea that I was working on over years, to try to figure out how to get to that point without just jumping into it. And so by doing that, by thinking about it that way, I started working for my dad's business, because my dad's an entrepreneur and owns his own business. And so I worked for his company for a number of years, just kind of learning the ins and outs of like how to actually run a business, how you make money, like how do you invoice people? How do you take care of accounting? All those things I needed to learn and know. And so working at my dad's company allowed me to kind of figure that out. And then all the other companies that I worked for were just small businesses in general, maybe not necessarily breweries, but I worked for a homebrew shop that was a startup. And I learned a lot about just startup businesses at this homebrew shop called O'Connor's. And then I worked for Black Project and learned a ridiculous amount about starting a business and specifically a brewery there. So it kind of forced me to think about it more pragmatically, like, how are we actually going to make it work?
That is so smart of you to take that approach, because, as I said, sometimes you just get lost in the romantic notion of I'm going to be a brewery owner. And you don't realize that you're a small business owner. You've got to do all the accounting yourself. You're doing bloody everything.
Everything.
And that can sometimes be lost. Yeah. But you've gone about it a really great way, I think. Yeah.
Thank you.
So has it been a smooth transition for you?
Yeah, it has been. I love it. I mean, it's like, at first it was very, very difficult. I'm not going to lie. Like, there's obviously a romantic idea of starting a brewery, and that definitely comes true when you start a brewery. I think most people start breweries to have beers with people, and just to bring joy into other people's lives. Like, that's really, when you get down to it, like, that's why people start breweries. You know, you can make things, you can create things and directly sell them to people. And everybody's happier. It's win-win. But there's way more to it than that. You know, you got to think about just like every single aspect of what it takes to run a business, and it's considerable. So yeah, it's kind of brutal at first, but we're very happy.
I'm glad you're happy. That's great stuff. Hey there, thanks for listening. I'll get you back to the podcast in just a sec. But first, I need a favour, please. There's a link in the show notes as well as on my Facebook page for a quick 2-minute survey. I just want to make sure that these podcasts are something that you, the listener, really want to hear. And the best way to do that is to find out a bit more about you with a survey. It's really quick. I just want to know a few things about you and where you live, as well as give you the chance to tell me what you like or don't like about the Beer Healer interviews. All survey responses go into the draw to win a mystery beer pack. Thanks for your help. Now back to the podcast. Let's talk about the wild beers that you make, because, as I said to you before we started the interview today, like, they are kind of all the rage out here in this market right now, and obviously they are in yours as well.
Yeah.
Why do you think that's the case?
I think that there's kind of a couple of reasons for that, but mostly craft beer is kind of just like continuously evolved, and consumers are getting more, I guess, intelligent about it, and just like they're seeking more flavors and more intense flavors. And that's just kind of built on itself and built over and over again. And so it's kind of gotten to the point where people aren't just like happy drinking just a regular beer. I mean, most of the time they are, but a lot of the time they also want to seek out something new. And the whole market has gone in this direction, I feel like. And it's benefited small flexible brewers for the most part, at least here in the States. It's benefited us because we're super small. I released like 80 brands last year. So
wow.
6 to 9 brands a month, and you can release a lot of different brands. So yeah, I think that's one of the main things. It's just like these beers that we're making are very intense. They're super complex. There's like, even in our most basic beers, there's a number of layers of complexity to them. So I think that it just kind of strikes that chord with the consumer. Like, they're always looking for something new. I'm able to release 6 to 9 new batches every single month. And they're all different. They all have different fruit combinations and hop combinations and honestly yeast profiles and that kind of thing.
Listening to you say that with my marketing head on, I'm a marketer by trade. I was kind of thinking that sort of in a very saturated beer market, wild ales are pretty much your USP, your unique selling point, because as you say, then they're all unique with their combinations of hops and fruits and yeasts that you're almost creating something that is impossible to replicate. So in a very crowded beer market where everybody's doing, you know, IPAs or New England's or whatever the case may be, you're creating something that is unique.
Yeah, it is 100% impossible to replicate that exact beer again. And we do some recurring brands. Like we've released a couple beers multiple times, but we do stress the point, like, this is the third blend of this beer. It tastes different from all the other ones. But still, most of the beers we release are totally original. But yeah, that is definitely like one of the main selling points for us, is like, it's always something fresh.
And it's funny, the thing that's the best thing about the beers is also the worst thing about the beers, because you might make something that is fucking amazing.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, I wish I'd love to do it. And oh, I can't replicate it.
Yeah.
So it's good and bad.
Definitely had that experience for sure. It's inevitable. We do try to, you know, we try to put quality steps in to ensure that we're basically dumping the bottom percentage, like of all the batches. We just dump the worst because we feel like we want to be it's our goal to be world class. And you can't do that if you're selling the bottom 20% of your beer, the bottom whatever percent of your beer.
Yeah.
So we don't dump a certain percentage. We just dump the things that we deem have off flavors of any kind. So it's like, if it doesn't taste good, it's no questions asked. We just cut it and move on to the next thing. But yeah, it's tricky.
Now, they're unique and allows you to have that sort of differentiation in the market. But I'm tipping they're probably just also maybe more fun to make than your regular beers. Is that right?
Oh yeah, it's a blast. I mean, for us, it's funny because for us, we aren't even technically a brewery. We're fully licensed as a brewery, but we don't produce wort ourselves.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Oh, so I didn't realize that. Okay.
It's kind of a bizarre concept, but once you wrap your mind around it, it's not so different. So basically what we do is we have our recipes, and we send our recipe and our grain, and really all of our ingredients, raw ingredients, to local brewers. They brew it to our specifications. And then at the end of the brew day, so before any fermentation or yeast has occurred, we pick it up.
Oh, cool.
So we aren't even involved in the brew day, actually. So we just go there. But that's, for me, that the brew day itself is kind of monotonous. It's pretty much always the same, to varying degrees of stress and difficulty.
And lots of cleaning.
Yeah. And just absurd amount of cleaning, squeegeeing the floors. I did it for years. So yeah, it's just a lot of squeegeeing.
Lesson learned in your preparation to create a brewery.
Yeah, I think I squeegeed floors more than I did anything else in that preparation. But so for us, we kind of skip that whole part and get to the fun part, I think, as our brewery, which is the blending and the cellar work. And so that's like, to me, that's like coming up with the flavor combinations and actually incorporating them in the cellar. That's where we thrive, and blending, really. It all comes down to blending for us. If we were really anything, I would call us like a blender, essentially.
It's funny you should say that. One of the absolute hottest breweries, in inverted commas, in Australia right now is something very similar to your setup. They're called Wildflower. And Topher Baim does very similar to you. He brings in wort and then he's playing with, you know, different blends and different fermentation styles and aging and all that sort of stuff, very similar to you.
Definitely. And
people are just absolutely losing their mind over his beers.
Nice. Yeah.
Even though he's not technically a brewery. Yeah, had you heard of Wildflower before?
No, I haven't.
Okay, you need to check them out.
There's, apparently I do.
Yeah, Wildflower, La Serene, Black Arts, and a couple in my home state, Van Diemen and Bruny Island Brewing, all doing sort of variations of the farmhouse, funky wild ales kind of thing. There's some
nice.
It's really starting to take off out here. Yeah, absolutely. So back on your process, so you get the beer at the end of the day, and then what, you've got open top fermenters, wild yeast, cool ships, barrel aging, bottle condition. Is that sort of how you do it?
I nailed it, all the above. It depends on what we're brewing. If we're doing like a spontaneously fermented beer, we have a series where we travel to each of the Great Lakes that surround Michigan. And one of them's kind of further out. And we basically pair up with a brewery there and they brew the raw wort for us. And then we cool ship it like kind of near the lake. Sometimes right next to the lake, sometimes like 30 miles away. It just depends on the conditions and all that stuff. But somewhere in the region of the lake. And we get the wild cultures from, it's a really romantic idea of like capturing the cultures of that that lake. And then we bring it back to our facility the next day and pump it into barrels, steamed barrels, and let it ferment for a long time. For spontaneous beer, that's our standard process is we go to a brewery somewhere pretty far away. They brew our wort for us. We drive it back or we cool ship it, collect all the cultures, and then we drive it back the next day and do all the fermentation aging, etc. Blending. That's spontaneous awesome. Process. And then for the rest of our stuff, which is the bulk of what we make, is just mixed culture, open top fermentation. So we have kind of our house culture that we use in every single beer we make, which we kind of just store in one of our fooders. And anytime we have a new wort that comes in, we pull out of the bottom of the fooder and we inoculate the next batch with that. And it's kind of just a way of carrying on some semblance of stability, I guess, throughout our brands. And we also pitch some fresh Saison yeast, but not a lot. It's just a tiny little bit to make sure we actually get through fermentation. And then it's open top. So it's in a stainless IBC tank. It's just a 10 barrel square with probably a foot and a half manway on top. And then we just leave that manway open for about 3 to 5 days, depending on the cycle.
Cool. Do you have a name for your house strain yeast?
We don't. We used to call it Genetic Drift, but then we named a beer. We named one of our beers Genetic Drift.
Oh, right. Okay.
Like our first beer. I guess it's still technically called Genetic Drift, or yeast is. But we don't really call it that by name in the brewery anymore. But yeah. And it's just a random mixture of stuff that I captured from my parents' house in Holland, Michigan, which is kind of by Lake Michigan. So I captured stuff just off of like strawberry flowers and sticks and leaves and that kind of stuff. Random stuff. And there were a couple cultures that were good and sent them to a lab and they kind of banked it for us until we could actually open as a brewery. There's also just like random stuff. There's probably hundreds of cultures in there.
Nice.
Anytime we have a really good spontaneous beer, we dump a bottle of that into the culture. So it continuously evolves.
It sort of evolves a bit.
Yep.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yep.
Unreal. And so you're talking about strawberries there. What about like adding fruits and all that sort of thing? Are you doing that kind of stuff in your barrels as well? Or
So we do that also in the same tank that we are doing the open top fermentation in. So typically we'll do our week long or whatever long fermentation in stainless. And then from there, it'll go into some kind of oak. Usually we have two pretty large fooders, so we'll transfer into one of those. Or we have about 100 to 120 oak, small format oak barrels. So it'll open top ferment and then go into oak. In general, sometimes it stays in stainless, but and then basically it ages for some amount of months or years, and then we transfer it back from oak into those same IBCs that they started in, And then at that point, we will add fruit for a secondary fermentation on the fruit. We aren't really, we obviously live in a very heavy fruit growing region. But it's centralized on, stone fruits and blueberries, really good fruits. We love using local fruit, but it doesn't cover all our bases as far as like what we want for flavors. So we aren't really like, we aren't really too picky about our fruit sources outside of fruit season. So during fruit season, we are fully concentrated on Michigan grown fruit, probably, probably grown right up the street. We have, built up relationships with tons of farmers, in the area. And like our rhubarb farmer, we buy her pretty much her entire crop, every year. So like we have that relationship build up, and then we have a stone fruit farmer, that we go to every single year, and we have been for, this will be our fourth year. And so he knows what we're looking for and, can give us good deals on fruit that might not necessarily sell well in the grocery store. So that's a really good partnership once you've got those built up. But, so during fruit season, we use all local fruit. But then once fruit season's done, kind of late fall, we kind of go back to like, we still have to blend beer and we still have to make beer, and we still want to make creative beer. And so we are not opposed to buying purees from other parts of the country or even the world, to make a beer, but we do try to buy fruits that don't grow well or aren't easily accessible in our area general.
What is your favorite fruit to throw onto a beer?
Oh my gosh. Favorite fruit. I don't know. I feel like cherry should be my answer to that. But honestly, I tend to go towards more like peach. Peaches are probably my,
I'd go peach if I had to choose,
if I had to choose one fruit that's grown like locally, it'd probably be peaches. Just cause our, the peaches that we get are ridiculously good. And they're just like, I don't know, they're heritage peaches. So they're not just like peaches that you buy in the grocery store here. They are pretty small. They're really intensely flavored, and they just taste amazing in our beer. And we throw the pits in too. And I feel like aging on the pits adds another layer of complexity. You get a lot of like vanillins out of it and almond kind of flavors. So yeah, peaches is probably my favorite like local fruit. As far as anything else, like I'm really a sucker for passion fruit, guava, those more tropical flavors.
You talk about other fruits, but in my head right now, all I've got in my head going around and around is moving to the country. I'm going to eat a lot of peaches.
Oh God. Now peaches, I'm going to sing that song in my head. It's going to be stuck in my head for the rest of the night.
Just going round and round and round. So what has been the craziest ingredient you've ever, and look, it doesn't matter if it fails or not. I'm just wondering like what's been the craziest idea you've had to create a beer, you know, with some sort of adjunct?
I'd say my favorite thing that we've done is we've done this kind of fruit called huckleberries. I don't know if they have multiple names. I don't know what they're called in other parts of the world. But for us, they grow. They're actually little tomatoes. Or they're in the tomato family, and they taste kind of like a herbaceous blueberry. They're a little more potent than a blueberry, and they're a little more bitter, and they're a little more like herbal, I guess, generic herbal flavor. So we, for our Lake Superior spontaneous beer, it's in a series called the Laurentian series, is our spontaneous series that goes to each lake. So in that series, we, brewed a beer in Lake Superior or by Lake Superior. And we paired up with a farmer, in that region, in a city called Marquette. And they, specifically grew huckleberries just for us to put in one beer.
Wow. That's awesome.
And they're a kind of crazy, because they're like a kind of weird tomato related thing. they aren't easily harvestable. You have to harvest them by hand. And you have to harvest them one at a time.
So that beer is made with love.
I mean, I didn't harvest them by hand, but I know the farmers did, and I know it took them so long to harvest them. So that alone, was probably like the weirdest, most fun,
That's pretty
fruit
cool.
edition, adjunct edition that we've made.
That's pretty cool. I've got a mate down here in Tasmania, Will Tatchell from Van Diemen Brewing. He's taken the whole idea of his farmhouse and wild ale concept to really the next level. And he's now producing these things that he refers to as estate ales, which everything in the beer is sourced from within about 400 meters of his brew house. And what you're sort of explaining here now sort of sounds like, could that be a potential next step for you, maybe sort of considering, you know, growing all of your grains and everything there? You got your your yeast that's sort of on site yeast, and you could just make something that with a food mile of, I don't know, 100 or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say a very large portion of our beers are, the 100% of the ingredients are from within 150 miles of our brewery.
That's cool.
I'd say 40% of our beers are 100% Michigan grown ingredients.
Yep.
And really, it could easily be more than that if I just sacrifice the need to have tropical fruit in my repertoire. Yeah. But all 100% of our grain is grown in Michigan and like 130 miles away from us in Traverse City. So all of our grain is Michigan. So our base for every beer is all local. And that is a big part of what we do is, like, I don't know. I feel like I travel and try to drink beer or drink something in the region, and I want a good representation of that. And like, why would I buy a grain from somewhere else? It just doesn't even make sense. If we have good grain in my state, I should be using that.
Yeah.
So for us, it's just like kind of a practical thing. We feel like we should be supporting that business.
That's cool. Giving back.
Yeah. And also just like from a flavor profile, it's going to come through in the flavor. It's not going to taste the same as getting grain from somewhere else. It's going to be a distinctly like Michigan terroir. So
yeah, nice.
Yeah, that's why we like that.
Speaking of flavors, I'm just interested to know what you do in terms of your hop profiles in your beers, because obviously you're getting a lot of flavors and variations based on the yeast and your barrel aging and you know, the spontaneous fermentation, all that kind of stuff. So do you keep your hop profile or the flavors from the hops, you know, pretty simple in your base beers?
Yeah. So and most of our base beers, I would say 90% of the beers we release, we include only the federal minimum hop requirement.
Oh, right.
Which I will say is almost none.
Okay.
It's just enough to be considered a beer still. So for us, that's
really
about
interesting.
That is about 8 ounces in a 310 gallon batch. So you can convert that out, but it's really like, it's almost nothing. It's almost nothing. Yeah. It's
virtually no bitterness.
It's a handful.
Through.
Yeah. It's a handful of hops basically in a big tank is all it is. And we just do that because it's the federal minimum, but we also use hops sparingly to control acidity. So the bacteria we use are very hop intolerant. So basically when we brew the beer, it gets no hops in the wort whatsoever. So when we get the wort from the brewer, it's completely unhopped.
It's like a whiskey.
We throw our house cultures in there. Yeah. Yeah. It really is. Like we throw our hops in there, only after the beer has acidified to the point that we like. So the pH will drop on it. It'll start, you know, wherever it starts, 5 point, whatever. And then it'll drop down to the level that we deem appropriate for whatever beer we're making, which is usually about 3.2. And then once it gets down to 3.2, we'll just throw in these hops and acidification stops completely. So we use that to kind of control how acidic the beer gets.
Well, I can imagine you sitting up at the bar at the brewery there, just with home brewers sitting around you, just like hanging on every word. Do you have them coming in wanting to learn these skills from you?
Yeah, we do. We're pretty active in like just beer education in general. Yeah. I'd say, especially early on in the company, because I used to work for a homebrew store, so just educating people on beer was literally my job for a long time.
Yep,
for a year and a half. So I mean, it's a big part of that for sure. We like to host homebrew groups. There's tons of homebrew groups in the area, so we like to host them and basically just give them a tour and like talk about our production methods, because they can seem kind of insane for most brewers. But they work for us. So, But yeah, we definitely try to make education a big component of what we do.
That's cool. That's really good to hear. So, you know, obviously your beers are kind of at the pointy end of the market, I would say, you know, and you've got people who loved or who enjoy challenging beers, but what about the entry level drinkers that might visit your tap house? You know, the less experienced ones that, you know, maybe have only ever drunk, you know, PBRs or Bud Lights or something like that. And they're not necessarily going to go straight towards a barrel aged sour from the start. What do you do to start those people on their journey via your tap house?
So we've got a lot of kind of routes that people can take to get to, you know, the barrel aged sours. And we also don't expect everybody to just come in and be into it already. Most of our customers are, but not all of them. And so we have a couple, we have kind of a rotating Berliner Weiss series where it's like 3.5% alcohol with lime and some other fruit. And usually that's a very easy sell to somebody who likes like Bud Light Lime. We'll just say,
I was gonna say it's like a Bud Light Limerita or something.
Yeah, but not shit. You know, it's like it's like that, but not shitty.
Yeah.
So it's like we have accessible beers on, but they're still legitimate sour beers. It's a mixed culture sour. It's just low alcohol and it's very refreshing. And so we have those on tap. And we also, because of the laws here, we can also make wine and cider. So we try to keep a cider on. And also we make natural wine. So we have a pretty decent lineup of wine from 1 year, about 6 wines. And we have 4 piquettes, which is basically a wine spritzer made just from grapes and water.
Yep.
It's like 4.5% alcohol, spritzy, a little funky.
Your competitor for White Claw?
Yeah, I guess so. Something like that. So, we've got options though. Like we've got
cool.
things
That's
for
good.
People to drink if they don't come in like loving fruited sour beer. But honestly, like most people love
by the time they leave.
Most people like fruit. So when they come in and they're like, I want a Bud Light Lime or whatever, we'll be like, well, we've got like. You might want that, but maybe you should try this beer that's like, just tastes like cherry and vanilla. Like it tastes like a cherry pie. You should maybe try that. And a lot of the time we can win people over.
I find it really interesting. So with the wild ale style of beers, like my wife has never loved beer, but in the last sort of 2 years or so where I've been experimenting more with trying, you know, the sour ales and the wild ales and all that sort of thing, I've found that she's actually really started to enjoy them as well.
Yeah, I've
heard
that.
There's been occasions where she's loved it.
I've heard that so much. I mean, it's both ways. Like the husband comes in, their wife doesn't really like beer, but they love our beer. And the other way around happens a lot too, which is really great, I think, because it's like a new person that's enjoying our stuff. And that happens a shocking amount, because people get dragged to breweries that they don't necessarily want to go to. Like, oh, I've been to 30 breweries and they all make bitter IPAs, and I'm just like, so I think there's just, we're different enough too that it makes us stand out in that way too. So
it's really interesting to people who have drunk perhaps wine all their life that these things are sort of like a bit of a halfway house in a way, that some of those tastes and that you recognize from a wine can be in these beers. And so they're not so off-putting for some of those drinkers.
No, they're not offensive flavors.
Yeah.
Especially most of our beer is pretty heavily fruited. So really it's all about how you approach it. Sour beer kind of sounds negative, like it sounds bad, but the flavor profiles that we're putting out, like basically if you like sour candy, like if you grew up eating sour candy and that kind of stuff, this is less intense than those. So it's similar flavor profiles. Like it's really ultra fruity and like tart and really like kind of a lemony acidity. So it's accessible flavors.
Cool. Now look, I'm absolutely loving hearing what you're sharing with us today, because this is really interesting, all these different things that you're doing in your brewery. But one of the things that actually really sparked my attention when I was doing some research on you is the way that you sell your monthly bottle releases.
Yeah.
Now, I haven't seen this done in Australia that I can think of, but I think there'll be some brewers out there that would be really interested in how you set this up and how it works ongoing, because it really sounds like you've got a really passionate following for this thing, and it seems to be going really well for you. So can you just give us a bit of an overview on, on the, how you do this.
Sure. Yeah. So when we first opened, you know, I was talking about kind of earlier about how we wanted to think through like the business aspect of this project. And for us, my wife and I started the company, and it's just me and her that own the whole company. We don't have any investors, or anything like that. So that also meant that we had a very small pool of money to start the brewery with, almost nothing. We had about $60,000 to start the whole brewery with. So that's not much. It doesn't go far.
No,
we spend more than that every month now. So it's like kind of alarming how little amount of money that is. But because of that, we had to cut the brew house, which I'm really glad we did.
Yeah, good idea.
And then we also had to cut a tap room. We didn't have enough money to actually open a proper tap room. So it had to be a production facility only to start. And so that meant that to get our beer into the hands of the public and to make the like best profit margin on that, we had to do bottle releases. And so we figured once a month, we'll get all of our brands that are ready and we'll have people reserve them and then come pick them up on one day. So for the first year and a half of our existence, we were only open one day a month. Basically, we'd be like, okay, we have one beer available this month. It's open, reservations open on the second Saturday or the first Saturday at noon. And then you just hop on at noon and reserve your bottle, hopefully very quickly. Because the first couple of months, we just didn't even have very much. And so they just sold out in like a minute. And that went on for like 6 or 7 months, where it's just like you had to be on right at noon to get the bottle. And so because of that, it kind of built up this like cult following of people that were just like trying their hardest to get bottles every month. But what that allowed us to do is we didn't have to staff a tap room and we didn't have to pay a staff to open a tap room every single day. But we still moved probably as much beer as a lot of the other tap rooms in town. We just moved it all in one day.
That's unreal.
So we got
just
lucky.
Literally using an Eventbrite event, aren't you, to do it?
Yeah, we just use Eventbrite and it's super simple. It's just like a free ticket. So you just go on and you just reserve your ticket for free. And then that basically means that you're guaranteed that bottle if you come in on the pickup, you know, designated pickup window. So eventually we did open a tap room that's just like, it was connected to our production facility. So it's just easy for us to open and we had cash flow then. So we could actually afford to do it.
But you're still doing this though, aren't you, with the Eventbrite?
Yeah, we still make the majority of our money through our bottle releases.
That is excellent.
I'm super happy that it has continued because we were really worried that the people would stop following the releases because we had a tap room, but that is not proven to be true, because I think so many of our customers come from such a wide region that they only want to come to our place once a month anyways. So it's just a convenient
and everything.
Yeah, it's just a convenient thing to build into their monthly schedule. Like every second Saturday, we know we're going to take a trip out to Speciation to pick up our bottles.
And you know what? In terms of promoting your brewery, there's always new news to tell because each month you've got this thing that you can talk about on your social media or to your email followers or whatever the case may be. So, you know, instead of having to just put out your generic, hey, this is our beer, I hope you like it type pick, you're talking about an event at the brewery. You can then, you know, maybe invite food trucks along or a band or something like that and just make it a really big, almost little mini festival every month.
Totally. It's a really great idea. It's a little party every, like one weekend out of every month. It's a little party at our tap room. It's really great. And I feel like all of our customers love it because they all travel from all over the place and they all see each other, you know, this one day a month and get to hang out with their friends.
Oh, yeah, it's like a social gathering. Yeah.
It's totally. Yeah. People trade bottles. So it's like,
oh, that's pretty cool.
It's a very, like many people set up their monthly trade sessions where they like show up in person to trade bottles at our releases every single month. So it's just built into their routine and it's like really great to see that we've become a part of the community in that way.
That is, I'm going to say that's fucking genius.
Thank you. It wasn't our idea. I stole the idea from Casey Brewing and Blending in Denver, Colorado. I didn't steal it. I borrowed it and modified it.
modified it. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's, he was doing it for a couple of years, in Denver while I was working in Denver, or not in Denver, but in Colorado. So he's in Glenwood Springs, I think, about 3 hours away from 3 hours west of Denver. But yeah, so he did monthly bottle releases, and I saw how successful that was and kind of took the idea and ran with it.
I don't know if anybody doing it in Australia. They may be, but I'm not aware of it. But I think it's just a brilliant idea. Just ticks so many boxes for a small brewery trying to, you know, make their way in the world today.
It's really honestly, it's really, really difficult running a brewery. And opening that way takes a lot of the stress of the day-to-day tap room out, out of the picture. And it takes a lot of the financial pressure off the picture or out of the picture too. And it allows you to just focus on making a couple beers a month.
Now I've got another song going around in my head. Making the way in the world today takes everything you got.
Oh my gosh, you're full of earworms.
I am tired today. I don't know what's going on with me. I'm all over the shop, more than normal. Hey, just thinking back on those beers that you're making, you know, try and get the entry level people in. I was just wondering, have you ever made and released just like a standard IPA or American Pale Ale?
No.
No,
never.
Fair enough. More power to you. You've got this little niche that you're working with, and it seems to be going really well for you. And you are sticking to your guns. I bloody love it. It's great stuff, mate. It's been a really interesting chat with you today.
Thank you.
I probably need to let you get back to things because it's lunchtime here and probably almost bedtime for you.
Almost
over there. Look, mate. Thanks for joining me. I wish you the best in what you're doing. And as I said to you before, I'd love to get to Michigan one day and maybe even pay you a visit because it's something pretty special, I think, what you're going on there. So thanks for your time today and best of luck for the future.
Of course. Thank you for having me. If you come to Michigan, you are welcome to stay with us. It's honestly a great state. I love it here.
I've got a family of 15. Will we fit? No, I'm just joking.
Oh, boy.
I'd love to come and pay the brewery visit. Thanks very much, mate, for your time. It's been brilliant.
Cool. Cheers.
Cheers. Thanks for tuning in to another Beer Healer interview. I really hope you guys enjoyed the episode as much as I did. If you want to follow along with more Beer Healer content, you can check out my Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram pages. Just search Beer Healer, or you can visit beerhealer.com. If you like the podcast, can you please help me spread the word by subscribing and rating it and sharing it with your beer-loving friends?